Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to What Clinicians Want to Know. As today, we're going to talk about the optimal management of metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Kevin Pooney, Professor Kevin Pooney, from the Zass Hospitals in Antwerp, Belgium, and Dr. Tiffany Traina from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. Today, we're going to talk about triple-negative breast cancer metastatic disease. You've heard the term real world. Well, we're going to get deep into the real world today for this conference. We will be talking about the use of unapproved agents and regimens, so check out the package inserts for more information. Here's where we're heading. We're going to start out with a little bit of an introduction, then we'll spend most of our time talking about first-line and sequencing and BRCA wild-type metastatic triple-negative disease. We'll also talk a little bit about BRCA mutant disease and some novel approaches, and then give you a little bit of a preview about what's going to be happening at the ASCO meeting of breast cancer, of a triple-negative breast cancer in particular. So actually, with the basis of what we're going to do, I said this is real world. So in the last couple of weeks, we did a survey of 50 U.S.-based general medical oncologists. That's our primary target audience. These are the same docs. They're not just taking care of breast cancer, but CLL, myeloma, bladder cancer, and everything else. And we'll see what their perspectives are. Interesting that maybe bring up the fact that just today we found out from the FDA that the ODAC committee turned down SERENA-6, the stroke that was first presented at last year's ASCO meeting. The use of camizestrin in patients in the first-line metastatic setting using the oral SERD camizestrin in people who turn ESR1 mutant. I thought it was interesting that actually, even though ODAC turned it down, the vote was 6-3. We actually had a poster at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Meeting based on some surveys we did. We actually showed that of 20 investigators, 6 wanted to do SERENA-6 and 14 didn't. So it sounds like ODAC had the same answer. But relevant to our target audience, at the same time, that poster, we reported that 2/3 of general medical oncologists were ready to go for SERENA-6. So, of course, it's a very controversial question. We're not going to get into it today, but we will next week with Drs. Burstein and O'Shaughnessy. So this morning, I had the pleasure of working with Professor Sybil Lobel from Germany on another program. And Tiffany, she showed me this slide, which I just thought was fascinating. This is from originally, I think it was presented at ASCO in 2022. So the data is, a little bit old, but I'm not sure things have changed that much. And what this shows is the change in survival of patients once they're diagnosed with metastatic disease. Based on their ER and HER2. And you can see that over on the left there for HER2-positive disease, there's been a pretty significant increase in survival for HER2-positive disease. I'm sure some of that has to do with T-DXd, but probably other factors as well. We also see a pretty big jump in ER-positive HER2-negative disease, the third one. Again, almost double the survival. Maybe that's related to CDK. But then when you look at triple-negative disease, the numbers don't look anywhere near as positive and not as much of a change. I also note that both of you were involved in papers looking at more recent data in the, quote, real-world setting and also commenting on triple-negative disease and, again, emphasizing what could be described as maybe a lack of dramatic improvements. And Tiffany, I'm curious what your thoughts are about this. Whether you see any, in the near future, any hope for any part of metastatic disease, but including triple-negative disease, getting a little bit bigger bump in the metastatic setting. And also, just from a public health perspective, with all these subtypes, where management of localized disease may be contributing to improved survival, and for that matter, screening. So we'll just kind of start out with this more macro view of metastatic triple-negative disease. Any thoughts, Tiffany?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the data you shared are really sobering, and I'm thrilled to have seen those advances in ER-positive and HER2-positive breast cancer. We've had almost 15 new indications by the FDA for breast cancer-related therapies in the past several years. And so really robust and fruitful, yet the slope of that curve in triple negative has really been blunted. And I think probably the biggest advances we've had was the introduction of checkpoint inhibitors for advanced disease and early disease, as well as antibody drug conjugates and sacituzumab and TNBC. So I absolutely think there's reason to be hopeful because we have ongoing studies now moving up those highly effective antibody drug conjugates into the early stage setting, whether in the neoadjuvant setting or that high-risk residual disease setting. So I think there is reason to be hopeful that we will see that curve start to rise with improving survival as we move these highly active drugs into the earlier stage. You raise a great point about screening as well. I mean, we need to recall that most women with triple negative breast cancer have their age of onset and of diagnosis quite early. And we've been hearing recently recommendations coming out to actually defer screening in the U.S. and starting mammography at a later age, starting at 50. And so I think, you know, we still hold to starting that breast cancer screening at an early age in alignment with the guidelines as they stand today, because we do see TNBC occur in young women and really early detection is so important.
Kevin, any thoughts about these data and the sort of public health perspective on metastatic triple negative and triple negative disease in general?
Yeah, to prevent is better than to cure. So I agree that improvements in early detection and in screening and potentially also in prevention in the predisposition genetic subgroups will have the major impact, most impact on this population. And for the outcome of metastatic TNBC itself, I think some of the innovations like ADCs and potentially also ICI have not yet fully been captured, taking into account the cutoffs of these historic graphs that always shown huge improvements of HR positive and HER2 positive that set the advancements, if any, also when we would have later cutoffs, still remain very limited and too small. And therefore, we really need to prevent patients coming in this scenario of metastatic TNBC. At first.
And, you know, Tiffany, you mentioned immunotherapy. And another thing I've been talking about in a lot of our webinars recently has been what's been observed in extensive stage small cell, where with the introduction of IOs, actually, it was kind of a modest benefit. The overall survival for patients is still about 13 months, but they're seeing a tail on the curve, maybe 12 or 15% of people alive at 5 years versus almost nobody. They attribute that to IOs. Again, any hope of getting more of a tail on these survival curves in metastatic disease? And do you think that may be coming from immunotherapy?
I do think it is. I mean, we all have in our practices the handful of patients who've had an incredible response to chemotherapy plus checkpoint inhibitor. And we've even reached a point where we've been able to stop chemotherapy and use maintenance checkpoint inhibitor with patients with metastatic triple negative breast cancer living years and doing beautifully. And I think what we need to understand is how can we best predict who is going to derive that benefit? And can we expand that benefit beyond just the traditional PD-L1 positive population, which really in practice is only about 30 or so percent of all those women with advanced TNBC. So there's some hope to see if whether combination with antibody drug conjugate and checkpoint inhibitor might demonstrate some benefits even in the PD-L1 negative subgroup. And there's work going on that we've seen in a combination of, for example, datopotamab with durvalumab. But very small numbers, really just signal seeking and hypothesis generating at this point.
All right, well, let's get into the body, what we want to get into, particularly what we saw in this survey of the general community oncologists. I'll just point out a really great paper that Kevin was involved with looking at antibody drug conjugate targets in the post-mortem study. I think it was really fascinating work, as well as a very interesting study in early stage disease looking at lifestyle interventions in triple negative disease, a fasting diet and exercise program. So maybe you can check those out as well. This is a great graphic of getting into the targets that we have right now in oncology for antibody drug conjugates and breast cancer. But let's get into some scenarios. A few years back, people were saying to me, oh, you know, your stuff's a lot like what's on the boards. And the boards, from what I can tell, I still take the boards just to see what they're doing. And it's all about scenarios and what do you do. So we have a bunch of scenarios and a bunch of cases to run by the faculty, and we ran by these docs in practice. So Tiffany, a pretty straightforward situation, 65-year-old woman, good performance status, has asymptomatic bone mets, de novo presentation, something that we're seeing more and more, at least percent-wise, in trials. This patient has a CPS of 12, and the majority of the audience, after seeing the data less than a year ago now, goes with Sassy Pembro. Any, what's your answer to this, Tiffany, and what might cause you to think of something else?
Yeah, I would agree with what the respondents have said. ASCENT-04 had really compelling data for the combination of sacituzumab and pembrolizumab. And in the PD-L1 positive cohort of patients, our standard of care had been leading with chemotherapy and checkpoint inhibitor. We really want to include that checkpoint inhibitor in the first line setting because with subsequent lines, the benefit really erodes rather quickly. So I would say this is also my preferred choice. There may be a bit of a qualifier there because if this patient had a poorer performance status and has just asymptomatic bone lesions, there might be a place for thinking about perhaps capecitabine and a checkpoint inhibitor where we have safety data, where we may want perhaps a gentler, easier chemotherapy backbone. But we know we might be sacrificing a bit on PFS there, as was seen in ASCENT-04.
So we actually had the faculty take the survey too, so I know their answers. And Kevin, I know you gave the same answer for this scenario, but I'm curious, Kevin, what your thoughts are when we still say the patient is 65, still good performance status, now they have symptomatic liver mets, and most of the audience still, or most of the survey people still stay Sassy Pembro. I'm curious, are you do the same with symptomatic liver mets? We said brain mets requiring stereotactic surgery. Still, people are sticking with Sassy Pembro. When we go to age 80, kind of getting into Tiffany's realm, we start to see a little bit of drop off, maybe more Pembro and paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel. So, Kevin, any other thoughts about what the GMOs, the general oncologists, say about these scenarios?
Yeah, I think I agree with the respondents. So indeed, I think the majority opted for SG Pembro for most scenarios, except the last one, which I also found quite difficult to choose myself. But I agree with Dr. Trena fully, completely, that you really want to raise this bar, this tail of the curve. We do not yet really know whether we do so by bringing the ADC checkpoint inhibitor combination up front, but I certainly agree that we increase the odds of the patients by doing so.
Tiffany, you had a thought?
I did. You know, I think we've seen now in multiple real-world data sets that the drop-off or attrition beyond first-line therapy is quite significant in TNBC, where only about 50% of patients are making it to second-line therapy. So I keep that in the back of my mind as well when I'm choosing that first line regimen. And I think it's why you saw most of the folks voting in all the other scenarios went with really our best regimen to date, which would be that combination Sassy Pembro, knowing that we may not have a chance to treat in the second line or third line when we're talking about TNBC.
Yeah, I saw that number in your real-world study. The other thing was in that real-world thing I was going to ask you about, Tiffany, is it looked like the people with PD-1 positivity did a lot better than PD-1 negative. And what's your thought about why? Is it just because of IOs or natural history? What's going on there?
You know, it is prognostic as well. So having a PD-L1 positive tumor is a better prognostic indicator. And then you add to that the predictive value of being able to get a checkpoint inhibitor, which I think incrementally gives you even greater success.
So, Kevin, we also presented a scenario. Again, we kind of kept it simple to start with de novo disease, but now PD-1 negative. But, of course, we also saw data with sacituzumab in this population as well that was positive, and we're waiting for more data from datopotamab. But the majority of the audience says PD-1 negative. They're not going to use chemo. And, you know, if you think back to the original premise of antibody-drug conjugates was it was supposed to be better than regular chemo. And it looks like that actually is the case. I'm not sure if it's that much better tolerated, but it certainly seems to be more effective. Again, Kevin, sacituzumab in the PD-1 negative population. And again, the audience or the survey, they still stick with SASI. With symptomatic visceral disease, with brain mets, and even in older patients. Any comments, Kevin, about the PD-1 negative patients?
Yeah, again, I think it's great to see that we have both positive studies with SG and Dato, DXZ in this setting. So I think the familiarity with SG potentially has driven somehow the responses we see among the participants to this survey. Actually, from a scientific point of view, I think both agents could qualify as a reasonable answer, but I would certainly prioritize an ADC in first line in the checkpoint ineligible patient population for the same reason of attrition Dr. Trainer has mentioned, which might be even higher in the PD-L1 negative population because of the adverse prognostic impact.
So in a second, we're going to bring in some of the cases that were submitted for your feedback in this survey, and we'll see a little bit more real world how this plays out. But of course, a big question that came out last summer, Tiffany, when we saw the data with SASI plus Pembro, is what about patients who'd gotten prior IO, particularly in the KEYNOTE-522 regimen being so widely used now. We saw when we said that the patient presents with metastasis 18 months after KEYNOTE-522, everybody's still on board with SASI Pembro. But when we bring it down to 5 months, a lot of people drop off the IO and just go with SASI. I mean, this is a common issue in oncology in general, when you have adjuvant therapy, then a delay. How does this line up with your own practice, mm-hmm. Tiffany?
Yeah, I think this is pretty typical of what I would do in my own practice as well. And if we think about KEYNOTE-355, which established first-line sort of chemotherapy pembrolizumab, if you looked at the disease-free interval, those folks that had a disease-free interval of less than 12 months did not appear to derive advantage to adding the checkpoint inhibitor to chemo. And that was before the days that we were even using a checkpoint inhibitor in the neoadjuvant and adjuvant setting. So I also use that 12-month kind of magical cutoff, less than 12 months, really not sure I'll get much out of re-challenging with a checkpoint inhibitor.
So this is an interesting question in terms of how people would indirectly compare efficacy of these two ADCs, datopotamab and sacituzumab. Most people feel that it's about the same. Kind of similar story, I think, with ER-positive disease, where often the side effects or administration issues overrule any other considerations. But we did see a survival benefit with dato and increased response rate, although there was no crossover in the sacituzumab study, so you really couldn't get a good grip on survival. Kevin, what's your take in terms of relative efficacy of these two ADCs in general and in triple negative disease?
So I think that the efficacy is hard to compare based on the data we have at the moment. So I would judge their efficacy as about the same. Study design features and small differences in patient populations do not really allow to compare directly the efficacy. So again, it's great to see both drugs have benefit for this patient population, and I would refrain, based on the current data, to declare one superior above the other.
So what about second-line therapy for those, Tiffany, who are able to make it to the second line? We said if your patient gets up Pembro chemotherapy, what would be next for the patient and with a HER2 IHC of zero everybody says sacituzumab. But what about in the HER2 low situation, Tiffany? What comes first, T-DXd or sacituzumab?
You know, in the hormone receptor negative setting, I still lean towards the TROP2 ADC first. And then if they have HER2 low disease, hope to sequence trastuzumab deruxtecan at a later line. You know, Destiny Breast 06 had really a hormone receptor positive focus, and Destiny Breast 04 was largely a hormone receptor positive trial with only about 50 to 60 patients with hormone receptor negative, triple negative breast cancer. We still have a lack of prospective data on how to optimally sequence these drugs, but I would tend to lead with the TROP2 ADC and TNBC.
All right. Well, let's go through some of these cases. We'll approach it fairly rapidly. We're not going to do an A to Z presentation, but really focus on the question that the doc brings up. So Kevin, young patient, 42 years old, had previously received KEYNOTE-522 that was completed 5 months ago. She then presents metastatic triple-negative disease, has a positive CPS, kind of like the scenario we were just talking about. The doc wants to know, is it Dato or SASE? And then what about immunotherapy in a patient who just finished immunotherapy 5 months ago? Also wants to know what your treatment after this would be. But Kevin, how would you think through treating this patient now, first-line metastatic disease?
Yeah, I would also abstain from adding a checkpoint inhibitor given the short treatment-free interval despite the PD-L1 positivity. I fully agree here with my colleague. I would feel comfortable when I could treat the patient with either Dato or Saki in the first line. And after progression on the first ADC, I find it very difficult based on current data on ADC sequencing in TNBC to say whether I would go immediately for a second TROP2 targeting ADC for the patient population that are HER2-low, where you switch at least one of the two key compounds of the ADC. I would probably be more tempted to go for ADC2, but then rather TDXD for the patients that are not HER2-low. I would really have difficulties deciding between eribulin or the second TROP2 targeting ADC.
So, you know, sequencing with ADC is such an interesting topic. Everybody seems to have a different view on it. Any comments, Tiffany?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the places where TROPION-Breast02 distinguished itself from ASCENT-03 in that the disease-free interval on TROPION-Breast02 had no lower limit. So there were patients, about 15% of patients on that trial were developing metastatic disease within 6 months of their adjuvant therapy, and 20% were within a year. So given this five-month disease-free interval, I would lean towards Dato in that setting. The ASCENT-03 study had a six-month disease-free interval, lower limit. But I would agree, not adding the checkpoint inhibitor. And then when we talk about sequencing, you know, in an ideal place, we would have different target and different payload. And we just aren't quite there yet. There are agents on the horizon. But right now, we're looking at trying to sequence three ADCs that either share a payload or share a target. And that makes it really challenging.
So before I go to the next case from the survey, I've got to bring up a case, even though it's localized, but wow, I just love it. I love asking this question. This is from Prethi in the chat room. So Kevin, 88-year-old woman, ECOG-1, 3 cm, ER positive low, less than 10%, PR negative, HER2 IHC 0, Ki-67 80%, status post-mastectomy. Is this what's your bar for ER to call something triple negative, Kevin? Under 10%? Are you going to treat it like triple negative? How do you approach these patients?
Yeah, I tend to follow the ASCO cap, the cap cutoff there. So up to 10% of cells staining positive for ER. So 10% of cells or less, I treat as triple negative.
pretty different world out there if you're triple negative or ER positive. So very important decision. Let's get back to cases from the survey. Tiffany, 58-year-old woman, metastatic disease, CPS of zero, HRD negative, mets of the liver, bone, and lymph node. Prior treatment for actually a HER2-positive tumor, as well as diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that I guess was cured. Patient ends up with cardiomyopathy, heart failure, pacemaker, gets neoadjuvant TC for triple-negative breast cancer, has residual disease, gets capecitabine. At the end of adjuvant treatment, has both ctDNA-positive, but actually radiologic progression 3 months later. The patient's been on sacituzumab for 4 years, which is really incredible. So the doc wants to know, do you retest PD-L1 status on progression? Any thoughts about this case? Any predictors? We've heard about TROP2 levels, Tiffany. Of course, we do TROP2 outside of breast cancer, lung cancer, gynecologic cancers. How do we find these people who respond so well to sacituzumab?
I know this is remarkable. I'm so happy to hear she did that well for 4 years. I would not be retesting PD-L1 at this point. Although if it has been so long since progression, I might biopsy just to again see what the IHC status is on the HER2. I know that we potentially can't re-challenge given her heart failure, her pacemaker, her cardiomyopathy, but I think that would be interesting information. I would also be sequencing to see if there's any mutations that might be targetable. But aside from that, I don't know that we have another predictor of benefit or response. TROP2 level of expression did not matter in terms of benefit from therapy.
So the next case, Kevin, I'm curious for your thoughts about it. It gets into the issue of relative tolerability of the various ADCs, Dato, sacituzumab, also sac-TMT. It's not approved at this point in the United States, but interesting data coming along. So I love this case in terms of trying to talk about toxicity. Another de novo patient with a CPS that's positive of 20, symptomatic bone mets and also pulmonary mets. History of corneal abrasions and wears contact lenses. Also has a history of IBS. And doesn't even want to get chemotherapy. So, Kevin, how do you, first of all, how do you look at comorbidities and when you try to decide, for example, between Dato and SASE? And any thoughts about this patient who's had issues with their contact lenses, but also inflammatory bowel disease?
Yeah, I think it's a great case to think about how the safety profile can drive treatment decisions. So in this hypothetical scenario where we would have access to both treatment options that have, for me, comparable efficacy, in this case, the patient features both a risk increase for either a Dato-induced toxicity, the corneal toxicity, or a Sacchi-induced diarrhea. I think from patient perspective, in my experience, having worked with Dato mainly in TB01 up to TB04, I think that the clinical impact of the ocular toxicity of Dato is very limited for the vast majority of patients. So despite the mucositis can be worrisome for those that suffer from it, I have rarely seen patients that really have a clinical impact from the corneal toxicity. So taking into account the increase of diarrhea you could expect in a patient who's already sensitive to it, I think that her comorbidity profile would rather push me using Dato instead of Sacchi. And I think the wear of contact lenses does not preclude a patient from Dato because they were also not excluded from the clinical trials. And I have myself included a few patients with contact lenses and certainly do not feel that this increases the risk for the ocular toxicity in a relevant way.
Tiffany, any thoughts? I'm proud to say we did a program last summer on ophthalmic issues in oncology. And then we did another one recently on hyperglycemic issues in oncology as well. So we were getting more and more to specialties. And actually, in the ophthalmic issue, they also, I think, reinforced Kevin's comments that the ocular issues with Dato usually are not that major like other drugs, belantamab, bafidotin, for example, on myeloma. But any thoughts about this Tiffany?
Yeah, I would agree that the ocular surface tox is really dry eye and manageable. My one concern here is that we do not have data for datopotamab with pembrolizumab. And you've said this patient has a very PD-L1 positive tumor where I would want to incorporate the checkpoint inhibitor. There are studies ongoing right now looking at Dato with durvalumab in the first-line metastatic setting, but we don't yet have that data, and we certainly don't have it in NCCN or FDA approved. So I think it makes it that much more challenging here because I would want to lean in with the checkpoint inhibitor. And I wonder if this is a place I might use a different chemo backbone and then use my ADC in the second line setting where we know sacituzumab has an overall survival advantage there.
So one more case, Kevin, 68-year-old woman, again, another patient who had prior KEYNOTE-522 regimen, but then develops an isolated brain met. No other metastatic disease. Patient gets SBRT. The patient's now ctDNA negative. I don't know if you even look at that, but of course, a lot of people are drawing that. Would you give systemic therapy? And if so, what therapy? Or would you just observe the patient closely, Kevin?
It's a data-free zone. We do not have clear evidence that we improve outcome by giving systemic therapy at this patient at the moment. So I feel very uncomfortable every time I am in this clinical scenario. But most of the time we end up by choosing a systemic therapy, and the type really depends on the patient profile. Certainly when they have a BRCA mutation, I would go for a PARP inhibitor in this case. It really depends, but usually I would feel uncomfortable not giving systemic therapy.
So we're not going to spend a lot of time going through the papers. I think we've seen the data a lot. We're really here to talk about clinical management. I just want the audience to know that we do have in our slide deck all the key trials that we've just been talking about, I think, including some data from from SAC-TMT. I think we've heard a lot about this issue of potential synergy between IOs and ADCs. We see that throughout oncology, even particularly in, we mentioned next week, we're going to talk about bladder cancer there with enfortumab vedotin and pembro, amazing long-term outcomes in metastatic disease. We'll see whether we see that with breast cancer. But also the issue, we talked a little bit about side effects and toxicity, Tiffany. I think everybody's familiar with the issue of with sacituzumab and neutropenia. We'll take a look at the survey in terms of whether or not people use preemptive growth factors or, for that matter, antidiarrheals, as was looked at in the PRIMED study, in terms of trying to prevent neutropenia and diarrhea. We asked in general how people view the tolerability of these agents. And a fair number of people think the tolerability globally is about the same, but a fair number of people think that Dato is more tolerable, and I think you both have already kind of spoken to that history. Here are some, getting into, again, comorbidities and selection of ADC, Tiffany. We say that patients has a history of COPD. I don't know how concerned you are about pneumonitis with Dato. Obviously, TDXD, it's a concern. Seems to be a lot less of a concern. I don't even know if it is a major concern. Do you agree, though?
Significantly less.
No, I was going to say, so, for example, with COPD, people seem to prefer SASE. Lingering cytopenias, people seem to prefer Dato, less than, you know, cytopenias there. Inflammatory bowel disease, as we just talked about with this case, people prefer Dato. Contact lens use, as we just talked about, people prefer sacituzumab. Anything you would add to that, Tiffany, in terms of tolerability? Also, in terms of whether or not, I'm curious whether you use preemptive G-CSF. Actually, a large percent of the audience, the GMOs use it for SASE, but not for Dato.
Yeah, I think that's appropriate. You know, the PRIME study really showed a significant reduction in neutropenic events. If you remember, there were deaths on study in the ASCENT trial with which would have been patients that by today's standards would have had growth factor to help mitigate neutropenic infection. So I do tend to use growth factor as a prophylaxis with SASE. I think something not even reflected in these metrics are some of the differences in schedule and chair time, which has an impact for patients who have to travel quite a distance to an infusion center in many parts of this country. So having a once every 3 week schedule is a nice favorable schedule versus a day one, day eight. Need for growth factor varies by regimen. GI toxicity is one. You mentioned the COPD question. The ILD rates with datopotamab were very, very low. And so the screening and monitoring is not the same as what is necessary for T-DXd.
So I think, Kevin, you mentioned the issue of mucositis with dato. And of course, we've heard a lot about the importance of trying to prevent it with particularly corticosteroid mouthwash. But we just spent the weekend with the Florida cancer specialist in our weekend annual weekend-long meeting, and the FCS docs brought up something I never heard of. I'm curious whether either of you two did, and here's just a couple of slides that we put in the deck, a chemo mouthpiece, which I've never even heard of before. It's like you can see they look like they're kind of like popsicles or something that you put in the mouth. I know I've kind of heard negative things about using ice chips because of the half-life, et cetera. But Kevin, have you ever seen anything like this? Does it make sense? I guess the patient keeps these in the freezer and they put it in their mouth and keep it cold.
Well, I have to admit that I haven't seen it yet. But this is very interesting. And I agree with the half-life of these ADCs. Giving something during the administration only will not be enough.
Well, anyhow, I don't know if this is going to end up being used or whether it's going to be useful or not. I know, I mean, you can see pretty nasty mucositis with dato. I don't know if you've seen that, Tiffany. I keep hearing how important prevention is. Do you do once they actually, I don't know whether this type of device or this kind of strategy might even help once the patient develops it. What do you use to try to prevent mucositis, Tiffany? You use the mouthwash?
I do. So we counsel to use a dexamethasone oral rinse 4 times a day. On top of that, good oral hygiene, topical clobetasol that you could put on a Q-tip right onto lesions can be helpful, a little bit more concentrated treatment. Obviously, lidocaine is helpful for analgesia, but really prevention is so key.
So, Kevin, I don't know whether it seems pretty likely, if not possible, that SAC TMT, sacituzumab tiramatecan, might end up being an option here. It's a TROP2 ADC. What do we know about the tolerability profile? I've kind of heard it's somewhere in between dato and SASE, but any comments, Kevin? Have you actually used SAC TMT? What do you see tolerability wise?
I have limited clinical trial experience, and I agree it's in between. Dato has more on-target toxicity, SACI has more off-target toxicity, and SAC-TMT seems to have a little bit of both, which makes it, at the moment, from a tolerability profile, a little less attractive to me. So really looking forward to see the efficacy data, and also this drug has another administration schedule, two weekly, so the three TROP2 ADC will all have their own administration schedule and safety profile. But the intermediate one, I'm not sure if it really offers a benefit above the two edges of the spectrum we have with Dato and SACI.
So, Tiffany, I mentioned we're doing a program on prostate cancer coming up at AUA. And one of the big stories in prostate cancer is they've been using PARP inhibitors, and now they've got a trial, hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. That's kind of our equivalent to first-line therapy. Mm-hmm. They're all excited about using PARP earlier in prostate cancer. And here's a case of a patient with a BRCA germline mutation with de novo metastatic disease. She's also HER2 low. She's also PD-L1 positive. So the question is, what's optimal first-line therapy for a patient with a BRCA mutation? The audience is still saying IO, or let's say chemo or IO, so sacituzumab or pembro with chemo, and gemcitabine carbo makes sense because of the platinum with BRCA. But there in between is olaparib as a possibility. So, Tiffany, how are you going to think through somebody who's BRCA positive but also PD-L1 positive?
Yeah, I think these top three options that the audience has voted for all have a good rationale behind each one, right? So for sacituzumab with pembrolizumab, patients with a germline BRCA mutation would be thought to benefit from sacituzumab given the TOPO1 payload mechanism of action. So I would be comfortable using that combination in a patient with a BRCA mutation. NCCN guidelines would say in that co-expression of PD-L1 positivity and germline PARP inhibitor to still be sure we're getting that first-line checkpoint inhibitor. But you could imagine a scenario where perhaps the burden of disease is quite low, as in this patient, and perhaps you want to lead with single-agent olaparib, reserving then your checkpoint inhibitor and ADC for the second-line setting. So I think you start to see that shift a little bit here. Now the patient has symptomatic visceral disease. A lot more folks leaning into that ADC with pembrolizumab, which makes good sense.
So any comments on this, Kevin? And also, we say suppose the patient has brain mets, and there by far the most common answer is sacituzumab and pembrolizumab. But also we get back to age 80, and at least the general oncologists now flip up to olaparib. So any thoughts about these other scenarios, Kevin?
Yeah, I think I agree with the respondents. I have to say that what still strikes me is the PFS that has been reached in the BROCADE-3 study with carbotaxane combination. So still, I think that pembro, gemcitabine, carboplatin for the BRCA mutant population. The jury is out there. I do believe that SG-PEMBO is also a relevant option for me, but whether the sequence of giving the PEMBO, gemcitabine, and then mainly platinum with SG in second line, rather than giving SG later, the jury is out there what on the long run will be the best. So I would feel comfortable for both, but probably agree with Dr. Traina that I would go for SG Pembro also for BRCA mutant. The thing for sure is that I would want to have the checkpoint inhibitor on board in the first line, given the EOS benefit there.
I was just flashing on Tiffany's comment that, you know, her answers line up with the survey. And it's really amazing how often the responses of general oncologists mirror what we see with the investigators. And it's really an incredible challenge for these docs to keep up to date and everything. We had another, in one of our other posts, we had four posters of San Antonio, and one of them, I forget which one it was, we talked about how familiar general medical oncologists were with the 10 phase 3 trials you need to understand in order to decide second-line endocrine therapy of breast cancer. So there's just so much data coming out here nowadays in oncology. I can't applaud the general oncologists enough for keeping up to date. All right, let's get into the cases, too, because I think you really see the granularity of the challenges of all these situations when you see real people. Tiffany, 56-year-old woman, BRCA mutant, de novo metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, PD-1 positive with 10, HER2 2+. So we got several biomarkers here to think about. She's got mets to the bone, liver, and lymph nodes, history of hypertension, hyperlipidemia. This doc chose to use SG and Pembro, but wants to know where does PARP inhibitors or olaparib fit in? Where does TDXD fit in potentially in a patient like this who's HER2 positive? Would you ever do sort of an ovarian kind of approach where you'd use some type of induction followed by PARP maintenance? I don't even know if that's even been studied in breast cancer. Tiffany, how do you approach a case like this?
Yeah, great question. So I agree with leading with SG and Pembro in this case. And the question about whether there's been a study around induction therapy, there was a randomized prospective study of using Gem-Carbo, as a surrogate response to a platinum-based regimen as a surrogate for benefit to a PARP inhibitor. So an induction of a few cycles, then discontinue that and use checkpoint inhibitor and olaparib as a maintenance. And that actually didn't really pan out. So I think in this case, I would lead with sacituzumab, pembrolizumab until the point of progression of disease where we need to stop therapy. And in the second line setting, obviously it'll depend on performance status and sites of disease. But I might think about a sandwich approach here and use olaparib in the second line before coming in with T-DXd, perhaps in the third line setting, and leveraging that HER2-low expression. We know the earlier we use the PARP inhibitor, also sort of the better benefit.
Kevin, any thoughts about this? A general oncologist always asking me, why don't we use some kind of platinum-induced induction with IO and do PARP maintenance? I don't even know if it's been studied. That's standard of care with ovary. But any thoughts about the BRCA mutant patient in the metastatic setting, Kevin?
Yeah, I really like the approach of Dr. Traina following SG Pembro first line olaparib. I would keep it until progression because maintenance sounds interesting, but we also throw away a line which we won't have left at progression. And so I would sandwich indeed here with olaparib preferred second line treatment or talazoparib, and then followed by T-DXd as a third line treatment option.
All right. So here's another case. One of my favorite mutations, Tiffany, 69-year-old woman, metastatic triple negative disease of the bone, lungs, and lymph nodes, PALB2 mutant. I've heard people call that BRCA3, HER2 ultra low, history hypertension. So again, this patient's actually been on olaparib for 18 months. And the question is, what comes next? But also your thoughts about what kind of mutations you get excited about PARP inhibitors is, in your mind, is PALB2 just as important a target? And what about some of the other ones like ATM?
Yeah, we have seen data looking at the use of olaparib in the TBCRC trial in various somatic mutations as well as germline PALB2. And the two sort of categories that rose to the top of having greatest benefit was germline PALB2 or somatic BRCA1 or somatic BRCA2. So ATM, not as compelling. CHK2, not as compelling. But here, not a surprise that olaparib gave benefit for some time here with a PALB2 mutation. I think the question raised here, you always have such challenging cases. HER2 ultra-low is not really a biomarker here in the triple negative setting, right? The DESTINY-Breast06 study was a hormone receptor positive trial. So I might be thinking instead of either SG or Dato in that first line metastatic setting with a short disease-free interval.
I want to talk a little bit about some other approaches in metastatic triple negative disease. In this case here that was in the survey, I hear a lot of people bringing this up, particularly when they know Tiffany's going to be on the program. 74-year-old woman, metastatic triple negative disease, the bone and lung, history of diabetes, chronic renal disease, neoadjuvant ACT 4 years ago. On foundation testing, she has androgen receptor positivity. Would you consider the use of bicalutamide or enzalutamide in this patient? This patient also has a PD-1 of 80%. Tiffany, I know you're involved in a lot of trials looking at this. TBCRC looking at enzalutamide with mifepristone. Really interesting thought here. Another study looking at feasibility of enzalutamide. Of course, we talk about enzalutamide and the other androgen receptor pathway inhibitors, as well as a study looking at abema and bicalutamide. So, Tiffany, where are we right now? How often do you see androgen receptor abnormalities, and are these really responsive to endocrine manipulation?
Yeah, terrific question. So, you know, depending on the assay used, we're seeing AR positivity about a third to as much as a half of TNBCs. We are still studying this, and actually the TBCRC 58 trial is a large randomized study going on around the country to really start to compare the AR antagonist against standard of care chemotherapy, and this is recruiting patients up to third line setting. So I do think that what we hope to gain from this is not only some efficacy data, but really developing a biomarker beyond just AR by IHC to fully enrich for the right kind of patient that could derive benefit here. Yes, we're seeing activity, but I think we really need to better understand what the selective biomarker will be.
So, Tiffany, what about AR degraders? We're starting to hear about that in prostate cancer. Obviously, we have ER degraders. We have BTK degraders in CLL. And are there any situations right now you run out of options where you would try some form of an androgen-based therapy in a patient who has no other options right now?
Yeah, you know, I guess the data that we've seen is largely single-arm phase two non-randomized data with a suggestion of a clinical benefit from bicalutamide, enzalutamide, even other AR antagonists and CYP17 inhibitors that were in development. So I think the AR degraders are really interesting. We don't have data for them in breast cancer. The side effect profile for an AR antagonist is quite favorable compared to, say, chemotherapy or an ADC. So if you're talking about a patient with a very poor performance status, I think it could be a consideration, but that is entirely off-label, right? And in the absence of randomized data.
So, Kevin, any situations where you have or would try some type of androgen approach? Again, as Kevin said, these are very well-tolerated agents. I can imagine a patient who might have quickly run out of options, pretty easy to do in triple-negative disease. Any situation would you have you ever done it, Kevin?
Yeah, well, we have to admit, Abicar is a Belgian study, so I was in the study design committee. So the combination of abemaciclib and bicalutamide is available in a single arm study. So it's a very liberal eligibility criteria. So we do use this option a lot for Belgian patients, but I also agree that AR positivity on IHC correlates poorly, I think, with really how much the AR pathway drives the disease. So despite, I believe that some luminal androgen receptor subtype and potentially also some very rare adenoid cystic TNBC subtypes really are driven by androgen receptor, not all AR positive TNBC is, I think, AR dependent. And this will really be the struggle in the next years to move this spot forward. And also not only degraders, I think also strangely to me to understand, but maybe Dr. Trena can comment on this somehow. Also androgen agonists seems to have sometimes a positive biological effect, which is very hard for my brain to understand, but we haven't seen all of it regarding this pathway. It's very intriguing.
Yeah, I would agree. And it's also very different in the hormone receptor positive, estrogen receptor positive space, how androgen interacts with ER. And so there's still so much to figure out.
So, you know, for people who have been in oncology more than 20 years, you might not know that there actually is a drug called halotestin. I don't even know if it's available anymore. It's a high-dose impeded androgen that was used. Even high-dose DES was used to treat breast cancer at one point. So, you know, counterintuitive why these agents would work. Anyhow, so thanks to the faculty, Tiffany and Kevin. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Tiffany. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice to see you both.